Okay. So for the two big elements of the class, and that what you guys should kind of tuck away in your notes or however you want to do it, or you can come back and listen to my lectures in 3 to 5 years whenever you sit for an exam, there's one section on your AREs when you take your licensing exam that covers contracts. And so that's why the first three classes or first 2.5 classes, I do a lot about contracts to get you guys to kind of understand. And at the end of the day, as I keep coming back to it, it's the rules of the Monopoly game of what you're doing and how you're playing it. But I wanted to give this foundation, this base, because in a few weeks we'll go in and we'll talk about the D101, which is the owner architect agreement from the AAA suite of documents. And then after, in the second part of the class, we'll talk about the A201, which is the owner contractor from the AAA suite of documents. And so the important thing is for you guys to kind of understand how contracts work and if something goes wrong. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. Today, we're going to, the first half of the class, we're going to talk about what happens if things go wrong. What happens if there's a breach? And how do the parties, how do they get through it? What are the rules? Again, back to Monopoly. What are the rules of somebody if they breach a contract? So, you enter into an agreement with a party and somebody doesn't perform, what happens next? So that's what we're going to talk about today. And I try to make it pretty basic and pretty simple, but the good thing is that's kind of the way contracts are. Where things get confusing in the law and contracts and everything else is less about, most of the time, less about the written word and what to do about it. It's more about the facts and how the parties acted to determine, well, did they breach or did they not breach? What's the remedy? What's the measure of damages? How do you calculate those things? So, like, when you go into a lawsuit, like right now I have, I represent a client, a homeowner, and a fairly substantial home. And there are lots and lots of problems. Lots of the roof leaks, the doors don't close, the floors buckle, the doors are cracking. I mean, it's just a mess. There was a movie years ago with, I think it was Michael Keaton, and called The Money Pit. I think that's who it was in. But it was about, that's where this thing is. There's just so many problems in the house. There's really no question in the lawsuit as to, did something go wrong? We know that there was a breach. The big question is, and where all the time and effort is being spent is, was it the contractor's fault? Was it the architect's fault? Which one? Well, I think it's both. And then once you figure that out, and that's based on their contract obligations, then the next question is, okay, how do we differentiate between what the architect should have done and failed to do and what the contractor should have done and failed to do? And then from there, you have to kind of figure out, well, what did they actually do during the process? So that's where the facts come in and it becomes confusing because the contracts are pretty simple. And then from there, you have to figure out, okay, well, what's the cost? And then you get into questions like, well, when they fixed it, did the person who's fixing it, did the homeowner fix it? Did they spend too much? You know, did they correct it in the same way as the original people built it? You know, so there's lots of things that come in. So the basic of the contract is pretty simple. It's the application that gets confusing. So that's what we're going to try to do today, is kind of combine the two, since we've learned a little bit last week or so about how contracts are put together and the elements. Now we're going to get into breach and we'll figure out, well, how do we sort these things out? So, let's talk about the breach. If there's a breach, what are your remedies? What do you do? So what is a breach of contract? Well, breach of contract is that it's really simple. It's a failure of a party to perform or fulfill its promise or its obligations under contract. So we enter into an agreement. I will design this house for you, this $1 million house for you, and you'll pay me $150,000. That's the agreement. Now, there's going to be other duties and obligations within that agreement. Some may be written, as we've learned. Some may be oral. Some may be implied by industry standards. So we can have this oral contract that says, I promise to design you a house. You pay me $150,000, and it's the $1 million house. That's your contract. But what may be implied, as we learned last week, said, I'm going to be doing it in accordance with the standard of care. I'm not going to design you a crappy house. And you're going to be anticipating that it's going to be a house that's $1 million, so I'm not going to specify, you know, that the floors in the kitchen are linoleum. In fact, they're probably going to be hardwood floors or stuff like that. So there's going to be these certain, whether even if it's an oral agreement, there's going to be certain implied understandings. And so if I fail in my design, or if I fail to do it timely, or if I fail to design it so that the walls fall down, or the roof leaks, or the floors crack, then I've breached my contract, even though it may not be in detail. And so one of the things that you'll learn, and I'll talk about and mention throughout the semester, but you'll learn when you get out there, none of your contracts that you ever enter into can cover every single thing. Just like you'll never have a set of drawings and specifications that will have 100% completion, because you couldn't put all that information in there. That's where you have industry standards and custom and practice and those types of things come in. But as a contract, they're all in there. So if you fail to perform in some of those things, you have breached the contract. Now, we'll get into the types of damages, but one other thing before we get into that. A designer, let's just keep it in the architect side, a design professional may breach the contract in such a way that they didn't fulfill a promise. But it may not be such a breach. One of the things they call it a material breach. It may not be so much that it warrants the owner, so if you guys are the owner and you've hired me, to fire me. So let's say, for example, I promise you I'm going to get you my schematic design drawings by October 1st. Well, if I get them to you by October 15th, I breached the contract. However, is that enough for you to say you've breached the contract, I'm going to terminate you? Probably not. It's not a material breach. So you can have different types of breaches, different levels, but it's all matters of breach. So if I'm late, what do I do? What remedy do you have over me in the event that I have not, if I fail to perform? Now, of course, if I never give you drawings, that would be considered a material breach. And if there's a material breach, then you would have different types of rights. So depending on the type of breach, the level of breach, and the remedy that you're seeking, get the last person in here. We're going to go through those series of remedies that are available to you or whomever, one of the parties in the contract. Okay. So, why do we want to talk about this? Well, as I said, if it's a contract, it can't enforce it. And if you enforce it, how do you enforce it? What happens? Well, if the parties don't perform, if someone fails to perform and there's a breach, you have to have a remedy. And so the remedy here, the purpose of it, and whether it's specifically spelled out in the contract, sometimes the contract will say, if this happens, this is the following remedy. Or sometimes it'll be silent. If it's silent, then we'll go through some of the issues that we have on today's lecture. But if the purpose is to put the innocent party in a position he would have been had the contract been fully performed. Because we all entered into this agreement. I'm going to do this for you, and you're going to do this for me. And so the intent in the very beginning was the full performance of the contract. Well, obviously, there's not full performance, so how do we get people back in the same position? And that, in that sense, you got to remember, it's not necessarily about punishing the party. So if I'm 2 weeks late in delivering your documents, your drawings, from October 1st to October 15th, should I be punished? No. What you want to do is you want to put the party who expected me to deliver the documents by October 1st in the position, had I performed that way? Well, what was the reason? So that's when you start to look at it. What was the reason that the drawing should have been done by October 1st? Well, if you remember, I said they were schematic design. So the phases, and we'll talk about phases a little bit later lecture, but when you do a design, your phases are schematic. That's just kind of overall three-dimensional representations and kind of putting together the general idea of what the project is. But the next is design development, and now you're starting to kind of flesh things out and floor plans and elevations and some sections, and that makes the house or whatever you're designing kind of more real for the owner. Then there's construction documents. You actually prepare the construction documents so that the contractor has a piece of paper or electronic documents or whatever they may be for which to build the space. And then there's contract administration and some other stuff on the back end. So if I'm 2 weeks late in giving you the schematic design, why did you want them? Well, you wanted those because the deadlines were important. If I get you the schematic design drawings late, if I get schematic drawings late, does that mean the design drawings will be late? And does that mean the construction drawings are late? And then project is ultimately late. So there's this kind of ripple effect. So you don't punish me, but you say, maybe a remedy here is how do you accelerate so I get the drawings done? So you have less time maybe to review the schematics, but once you give me the review, I have less time and I have to get you the design drawings done. So I hit my marks again. So we want to get everybody kind of back to the same level of what we expected, what we anticipated when we entered into the contract. So that's the purpose. Now, as I said, depending on what happens, there's different types of remedies and different types of damages. So in some instances, there's on a legal remedy, there's going to be monetary damages. In other instances, there's what's called an equitable remedy. And these are more if you have to take them to court or arbitration. But an equitable remedy will result, it's going to be an action, and it won't necessarily be a, it will not be a monetary payment. So you may, let's say that I am late, and I haven't performed and provided the documents. An equitable remedy may require me to accelerate. So there's no money changing hands, but I have to accelerate to get the work done more timely. Legal remedy would say, well, you have to pay me to bring somebody else in so we get the drawings faster, because I have to bring in two architects now to get the drawings done. And so you have to pay me. That's a legal remedy. That's a monetary damage. So we have legal and equitable. And then, kind of separate from that, there are these other ones. They're called consequential damages, liquidated damages, and punitive damages. Those damages will all be on the legal side. They're monetary based. And they are all going to be contractually written and to determine whether you are entitled to them or not. And they have kind of their own special triggers or circumstances. So in a traditional straight-up breach of contract case in construction, you may not get liquidated damages or punitive damages or consequential damages. It depends on what the contract says. So the court applies various facts, and we'll get into what those are and what the consequential liquidated and punitive damages are. But remember, in construction or any contract, you don't automatically get those bottom three. Okay. So let's talk about the first type of monetary damages. So the first and probably the most common is what's called expectation damages. So this was back, if you remember, if you go back one slide, the intent is to put the innocent party in a position they would have been had the contract been fully performed. Well, expectation damages is pretty much the same thing. If the whole contract was performed, how do we get there? What do we do? And the key here is this one, is the injured party recovers the difference, and this is remember said is monetary, covers the distance between the cost to complete the contract by another and the agreed on cost if the original party had performed. So what does that mean? Well, let's take our example. You have hired me to design you a house, and you've agreed to pay me $150,000. I start to work on the drawings, and I'm $75,000. Well, let me make it better. I'm $100,000 in. Okay, I've done two-thirds of the project for you. I've prepared schematic design drawings, design development, and we're through construction documents. And now we're going to go, we're going to start building the project. Okay? And you go out to bid with my drawings, and you've asked me for my advice on selecting a contractor, and there's three contractors out there, and one gives you the low bid. And I tell you, I've worked with this contractor before. They're terrible. They're going to do a poor job for you. I don't think you should use them. But you make the decision to go with them. Now, there's no contract agreement between us that I get to tell you who to contract with. Say you hire the terrible contractor. And I decide I can't work with this contractor. They're going to screw up my drawings. They're going to do everything. So I quit. Say, I'm out. I told you not to hire this guy. He's the worst. I'm out. But my contract for $150,000 was to get it all the way through completion. I was going to design, prepare the construction documents, and then I was going to manage the project on the design side and help you get it built. But I've quit now. So I'm okay with that. Now, you don't have to pay me the $50,000. No big deal. But I have breached the contract. So the owner in this instance, they have to hire an architect to come in and administer the drawings and kind of watch over the contractor's shoulders. And so they go out and they interview six or eight architects, and these architects say, well, I don't like this contractor either, but I will still manage the project for you, but it's going to cost you $75,000. And I'm like, well, I was going to pay the guy $50,000 to finish it out. And they're like, well, you can bring me on, but it'll be $75,000. So you have to pay that party $75,000 to perform the work. The expectation damages here is the difference between what you would have paid me and what you had to pay. So the expectation damages there is $25,000. The whole contract with me was $150,000 from start to finish. You expected start to finish for $150,000. But once I breached, you had to pay $175,000. You paid me $100,000 and someone else $75,000. So from start to finish, you paid $25,000 more than you expected. And that's due to my breach. And as a result, your expectation damages is the delta between what you should have paid and what you had to pay. Pretty basic. Make sense? Okay. So there's lots and lots of realities of how this kind of gets broken down. Like I said, I want to just keep it at the highest level of the expectations. But just to give you a couple of examples, and I'm not going to be putting these types of things in the exam, but I want to give you an example of what that is. So let's say I'm designing for you a special type of manufacturing system, okay? And I expect it to work in a certain way, and we see the drawings and specifications. And at some point in time, it fails to perform. The pumps aren't working properly, whatever it has to do. And so I have to go out and hire a new company to finish the job, just like you had to hire the new architect to finish the job that I breached on. Now, in this example, the pumps that were failing, that I had expected to do, were at the level of what's called, let's compare it to a Chevy. They drove, they're like a rock, they do what they're supposed to do, and they're just fine. Okay? Except they didn't work here. So I go out and hire a new contractor, and they bring in the Cadillac of these pumps. And I'm going to say, well, the pumps were supposed to cost $200,000 from you, but I had to spend $400,000. So based on the real basic example here, expectation damages, I recover the delta between the $200,000 pump and the $400,000 I spent. So I should get from you $200,000. But to make things a little bit confusing, and that's where lawyers get in, and that's where lawsuits get confusing, everything else is, the company that was providing you with the $200,000 pump said, wait a minute, you bought a Cadillac. If you went out and bought another Chevy and you spent $400,000, I'd owe you the $200,000. But you bought the Cadillac. That's why it was $400,000. So you got more than what we expected. That was a change of what the contract is. So that's where things get kind of a little bit different. Like, what was the fix? What was the remedy? What did the other side do? Who did they spend it? Did they hire a better contractor? Did they go outside of what everybody agreed to? So expectation damages is a real simple for your eyes benefit, is what you thought you should have paid, what you had to pay. But knowing that things can get a little bit more complicated out there, it's never quite that black and white. Just so you know, when you get out there, eventually, if you're ever in a lawsuit and somebody's talking about expectation damages, probably won't be as simple as this, but for your purposes for the exam, this is what you need to know. Okay. What's another monetary damage? So there's a couple more. The next one here is what's called reliance damages. So reliance damages, and again, you get monetary recovery here. It's awarded to an injured party who foreseeably relied on a promise, even if that promise that they relied on is unenforceable. So what does that mean? Well, we have this agreement between each other, and I promise one thing, and you heard me promise that, and on a reliance on that promise, you acted, you performed. And then the other side failed on their side to perform. So here's my example. You and I enter into an agreement. You want to buy a car, but you don't have the money. Or you don't, and you have some type of relationship or whatever it is. And I say to you, you know what? I'll give you $10,000 to go out and buy a car. That's a gift to you. I'll give you that money. It's my promise to you. If you go out and buy a car, you can spend $10,000. So you go out, you find an old beater, and you'll be able to buy it for $9,400. So you come to me because you relied on me. You relied on that promise. I never gave you the check for $10,000. I told you I would give you up to $10,000 to spend. And you relied on that. And you come to me and you say, I spent $9,400. Let me have my $9,400. I didn't even spend the $10,000. You're kind of proud of yourself because you kept it under the $10,000. If I fail to give you that $9,400, I breached the contract, and you can sue me for reliance damages. You relied on my promise, you acted on my promise, and as a result of that, you should be paid for your actions. Also, I want my money back. I gave you money to do something, so if it was the opposite, here, go out and do this, and if you fail to perform, I'm entitled to get my money back because my giving you money was reliance on you performing. Another example would be, and I think I gave this to you in an early lecture, maybe the first day, I'm not sure. So you're looking for a job, and you find out that there's a job opening at a company, and they want you to come across country. And you say, well, you don't have to move. I have to break my lease, and I have to drive across country, and I have to rent an apartment. And there's all these costs and expenses. And you get out there, and they say, there's no job. Well, you relied on the promise of the job. So you can make the argument that I'm entitled to your costs for moving out there. That would be a reliance damage. Now, interestingly enough about that is, let's say you just moved out there and got the job. It's very likely that they wouldn't have paid you for your moving expenses if you hadn't had a specific promise for them to pay your moving expenses. You probably wouldn't have gotten paid for that. But since you had a promise for a job and you relied on that, as a result of that reliance, you incurred damages. So that's one. Now the one last piece here is on this reliance damage is where I say sometimes even if it's an unenforceable promise. So what does that mean? Because the first promise is simple. You were going to give me $10,000 to spend on a car. I performed it. I bought the car. You owe me money. So that promise should be enforceable because we all acted and it was done. What's an unenforceable promise? Well, let's say I promised you to pay you $5,000 to paint the interior of my house. Okay? So I go in and I start paying, and, oh no, I'm sorry, that's part of restitution, I apologize. I know it is. So for the unenforceable and the reliance, I'm sorry, I got a little confusing there. The unenforceable and the reliance part of it is that job one. So the example is if there's a job. I can't force you to hire me. necessarily. And we'll get into that, reasons why there's a forcing of hiring or somebody or not hiring somebody. So the promise of the job, that you're going to do this specific type of work and everything else, may not be enforceable, but you still relied on that promise of the job and you incurred costs and damages. So that's what the unenforceable promise is there. There's another unenforceable one in restitution we'll talk about in a second. So, again, reliance is based on promises of performance and delivery, but it's different than expectation. One could make the argument, or could get confused, if I promised you I would design the house for $150,000 and I stop at a certain point in time, and you have to spend the additional money to finish the contract, that's why you get expectation damages. But in the reliance damages, it would be if you went ahead and did something in addition to that. You didn't hire somebody until after I breached. Whereas in reliance damages, you perform prior to the breach happening, and the breach itself is the failure of the other side to deliver the cost or return the money or perform the services. Does that make sense? So why there's a difference between expectation damages, somebody's already breached and then the party has to spend money to complete the contract, that's expectation damages. Whereas in reliance damages, the breach doesn't happen until after the performance has occurred. Does that make sense? Okay. Restitution damages. So that's the last type of monetary damages. So in that instance, it's where one party has provided a benefit to the other. So the first party needs to be compensated for that. So let's say, and another way of looking at that is unjust enrichment. So let's say you hire me to come in, and I think we gave this as another example. You hire me to come in to fix your roof. And there's one area on the roof that you know where it's leaking, and so I'm supposed to work in this one spot. But during the course of my performing that work, I recognize that there's other portions of the roof that have problems. And I go ahead and fix those as well, because they're going to be causing leaks and otherwise. Well, I should be paid for that additional services. Now, there could be some grumbling between the people saying, well, why did you do that? I didn't authorize you, and there's some other issues with that. But at the end of the day, if I perform that work, and I fix that part of the roof for you, you have received a benefit from me. That roof has been fixed. And if you don't pay me for my work, you will have been unjustly enriched. You got more benefit from me and never paid for it. So restitution is to try to make the parties whole in that sense. So restitution damages, if you hired me for $2,000 to fix one portion of the roof, and I spent another $750 fixing the other portion, restitution says I get paid both the $2,000 for the work that we contracted for and the $750 for what you were unjustly enriched. You shouldn't be able to get out of that just because we didn't have the contract for it on a very basic level. So now, how does this work with, as I said, in an unenforceable contract? Well, let's say that I was working on this, the example that I first started with on the restitution side, was you hired me for $5,000 to paint the entire interior of your house. Every room, every hall, every doorway, you come in and you say, how much is it going to cost? I look around, it's $5,000. I'll paint all the walls and doors and windows. Maybe the house, you're getting ready to sell it, and you want to make everything look nice and clean. You know, you had kids like mine, they drew crayons on the walls or whatever else. So you want to get it ready for sale. So you bring the team in, $5,000, paint the whole interior of the house. In the course of while the house is being painted, unrelated to my work as the painter, there's an electrical fire. It's an older house. There's been problems. That's why you want to move out. That's why you're selling it. There's an electrical fire, and the house burns down. Now, I've been working painting the house. I painted, let's say, $2,000 worth of my $5,000 contract. I've incurred costs for materials. I've had my team out there. I spent all this time. Now, I can't enforce the $5,000 contract because the house is burned to the ground. So the full contract is unenforceable. We had an agreement. You pay my whole house for $5,000, I pay you. We can't enforce that contract. There has been a major change to the circumstances. But just because the house burned down, and you as the seller, you're like, well, I didn't get a benefit. You know, that's the argument. I wasn't unjustly enriched because all of your paying doesn't matter. The house is burned down. Why should I have to pay you if the house burned down? So the courts are going to say, no, that's not right. They're going to say, you did get a benefit. And something unrelated to the work that they were performing caused the contract to be completely unenforceable. It couldn't actually be finished. But they still did the work. So as a result of restitution, you still owe them the $2,000. That's restitution. To put the parties back to making them whole for the work that was performed, even if it's not the full contract, and even if the full contract is not enforceable. Okay? So, I want you to kind of, if you have any questions about these, there will be a couple exam questions, and they're going to be either a fact scenario, and it's going to ask you which type of damage is this going to be. Was it restitution? Was it reliance? Or there's going to be a fact scenario where it's not going to tell you use a reliance calculation or restitution or expectation. It's just going to say who owes whom what. So I want you to kind of make sure you're good and comfortable if you understand. And the facts, like I said, what you kind of want to think about here is an expectation, money spent to complete the contract. In reliance, people have performed. So the performance has already been done, and they've incurred costs in that performance. And restitution is, you may have performed outside of the contract, or maybe the contract can't be finished or completed, but you're to be made whole. So that's your kind of cues when you're reading these fact scenarios on the exam as to which one applies, and then from that you want to figure out and do your calculations. Well, if it's expectations, it's additional costs. If it's reliance, what was my cost if I relied on? And restitution, what do I really get paid for with the work that I actually did? So, just as a little tip on exam questions. Any questions on those three? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you paid them. So the second part is the I want my money back remedy. Is there was a promise for them to perform, and you gave them money as an advance on that promise. So in reliance on them promising to perform, in that case it's the opposite. Like you said, they never performed, but you relied on that promise and you gave them money. So if they failed to perform at all, you are entitled to return of that money because you relied on that promise. So reliance damages is you focus on the promise, expectation focus on the completion cost, and restitution focus on the value of the work. Does that make sense? Okay. Any other questions on those three? So that's a great question. So the question, and what I just realized as you were asking the question, I'm like, I record this, but nobody hears the question because it's only in the headphones. So I got to figure out how to get over that for the next thing, even though we'll have the PowerPoint, the whole program here recorded. But anyway, the question is, what happens if they perform this additional work and never had authority or authorization for it, and may or may not have been necessary? Why would you have to pay for that? And that's a great question. And the reality is, that's one of the reasons why you want to have a written contract. If it's an oral contract, just go fix my roof, then you're leaving it up to interpretation of the parties fixing the roof to determine what should be fixed or not fixed. And if you think it's only going to be in Area 1, and they work on Area 2 and 3 as well, and they say, well, I fixed Area 2 and 3 as well, and you're like, I didn't want that fixed yet, I didn't need that fixed yet, then you get into the squabble. But they are going to make this argument that the kind of more general nature of what the scope of work was allowed them to have that, and they are entitled to restitution. This also, your question also kind of gets into a very important kind of point that I was making. The concept of restitution is really simple. If you're unjustly enriched, you have to pay somebody for that. If they perform the work, you should make them whole. But the application of it becomes very confusing in the sense of, was that really within their purview? Did they have the authority to go ahead and start making decisions that you may not want to have authorized them for? You could have said, you know what, you may have thought that those shingles look bad, but I just had that work redone last month or 2 years ago or something like that, and I wasn't going to authorize. So the answer is to your basic question, would you have to pay for that? Unfortunately, I have to use my famous words, it depends, because it depends on what the agreement was between the parties initially. If it was just go fix my roof, you may. If there was a written contract that says you're going to work on this area, and when we get into the B101 and the A201, and then at the end of the semester, I will give you guys a contract that you can use and should use for whatever you want going forward. You should have a provision in there that says that the contractor, in this instance, cannot do additional work outside of the scope without written authorization or something. So they need to come back to you and say, and you know, a good contractor should do this. A good contractor should come say, you know, I was looking and I was, when I was up there painting and I saw these problems, fixing your roof, I saw these problems, and I think you really should have it done. Do you want me to do that? That's what a good contractor will do. They'll communicate before they spend their own money, because they don't want to be on the hook. But at the same time, that's why if you have it in writing, you know, here's the scope of work, don't do anything without written authorization, then you get out of this restitution damage quandary that your question arises. But it does come up. And one of the biggest areas, and this is something, actually, I was having a discussion with my clients yesterday. So we'll talk about what's called a change order. We'll be talking about those more as we get into more details of how projects work and everything else. But for purposes of this discussion that I had with my client yesterday, and for your question, a change order is the parties enter into a contract and they define the scope of work. And then as the project's moving along, well, something changes and you want to increase the scope of work or decrease. So maybe it's that million-dollar house was a four-bedroom, three-bath house, and it turns out that you want five bedrooms. So even though we signed a contract for the four-bedroom, three-bath house, we issue a change order that changes the contract to make it that I'm designing you a five-bedroom house. Maybe I get paid a little more money, whatever that has to be. So to the restitution question you asked and how this is coming back in, what happens really in the field is sometimes a change order will occur on a project, and the parties in writing agree to that change order, so they follow the rules, they're not doing anything without authorization, and they sign the change order, and they get paid for it. And then something, as they're working on the scope of the change order, something else occurs. And the contractor thinks, oh, I got a change order approving me to do this work, I can do it. And the owner says, wait, no, the change order was for this narrow new scope, you've gone beyond it. And so that happens all the time in construction. And so my conversation with my client yesterday was, we included language in the actual written change order that says, this covers everything relating to this issue, And basically, I'm paraphrasing it, covers everything related to this issue, and even if you do more work, you're not getting paid any more money for it. So if you want something more, you have to come back and prove that it's different, and we do a different change order. So even in construction, where you have things in writing, sometimes issues can come up where one party interprets the meaning of the writing this way, and the other party determines the meaning of the writing in another way. And that's where lawsuits get more ugly and costly, is depositions. Well, what did you think this meant? What did you think this meant? What does this mean as the expert? So I know that's a long-winded answer to your question of what happens with, you know, why would you have to pay if the guy just goes and works on the parapet when they were only supposed to work on the radio part of the roof? A lot of it's based on what the scope is, what the agreement was, and how the parties acted during the course of the period. Very much so, yeah. The more specific you can be, the more detailed. Recognizing that you can never still, even a change order can't necessarily be 100% perfect. So there's this part of industry custom and standards. So one of the arguments might be back to your parapet question. So they're working on the roof and then they go work on the parapet. One of the arguments that you could say was industry custom and practice, even though we didn't have a written agreement on that change order or whatever it was, or not change order, a written agreement as to what you're supposed to do for your original scope. Industry custom and practice says you don't go in and start working on another area of the roof without communicating with me. So you use those, but if the more specific you can be, specificity is very important, yes. So, okay. So those are your basic three. Those are the big three for monetary damages. Now let's talk about equitable damages or equitable remedies. So an equitable remedy, the first one is an injunction. Now, I've given these examples. The first three are very good for construction-type projects. That's because in most construction projects, you're going to be seeking monetary damages. There may be some times where you're going to be looking for equitable relief in the construction world, but I want you to understand what they are in general. And these are going to apply to all different kinds of contracts. So an injunction, you're going to go to court, and you're going to ask them to require or forbid an action. So, you know, I mean, lots of injunctions happen all the time. You hear about them all the time where people run into court. You know, so they were going to be working on an area of land and going to put a highway through. So somebody wants to install a highway across, and the government comes in and tries to declare eminent domain, and we're going to put a roadway through right there. Well, you could go in an injunction, or seeking an injunction, and you could require the court to say, no, I don't want this highway to go through my land. So enjoin the government from putting a road through my land. That's not fair. So that's an injunction forbidding. On the flip side, let's say that the government's putting the roadway down, and they declare eminent domain, which is something that they're entitled to do, and you set up shop and you put your kids in the middle of where the plows are going to be, and you won't let them work and put this road right through the land. So you are precluding them from doing something that, arguably, if they've exhibited eminent domain and they offered to compensate you for taking over that land, and you refusing to let them, but you're not going to court, you're just doing a physical barrier. The government could potentially go in for an injunction to require you to get off the land to allow them to build the road. That eminent domain and that the value of the compensation entitles you to do that, and so the court could enjoin you from blocking them. So that's requiring you to do something. But in either instance, an injunction is a court order that is related to requiring or forbidding a certain type of action. Now let me think about how an injunction might work in construction. Well, I mean, the roadway that I was talking about here is that those are construction-related projects. But let's say you're building a building. There may be an injunction related to construction that you can't go over a height restriction or a setback. They're not necessarily going to enjoin you or require you to build the project in a certain way. But there's going to be certain potential elements around it that the court may require you to comply with other laws. And that's the action of compliance or forbidding you to do something. So that's how an injunction might work in construction. Any questions on that? That's probably going to be, of all these equitable ones, that's the one you hear about most in the news. I mean, you always hear about somebody going in for an injunction on this or an injunction on that. That's going to be the most common of the equitable remedies. Next one, rescission. So rescission is probably the least common of all these. And rescission is undoing the contract and returning both parties to status quo. And in that sense, status quo is if the contract never existed. And the reason why it's so rare is because courts are very loath to come in and unwind a deal, a transaction between the parties. And sometimes it's extremely difficult to unwind. How do you take the parties who may have partially performed or performed fully but failed in certain instances? How do you rescind that? How do you unwind that whole contract to get to the parties like nothing ever happened? And that's why it's difficult to enforce. It's difficult to apply because things have already occurred. But here's an example that I actually was involved in, a very specific case. It wasn't necessarily construction related, but it had some real estate and some little bit construction issues. I had a client who was looking to move into a subdivision and went to buy a house at the end of a cul-de-sac. Now, the subdivision was, the house was being bought from one of the developers that was developing the subdivision. And that house had existed for a while, and the subdivision developer was in charge of not just building the houses, but grading the land and putting down the roads and the gutters and the whole drainage system and everything else. And what it turned out was, during the course of the development of this subdivision, the contractor failed to do a couple things. They failed to properly grade the land, and then the sewage and drainage system was supposed to, as the water came down from a sloped hill, because the cul-de-sac at this area where my client bought the home was in the end of the cul-de-sac, as the water poured down through the various grading and everything else, it basically pooled in this cul-de-sac. It was supposed to go into the drains and then drain out into a retention pond that was in another area, kind of off. So just a big pond, it looked like a lake, and that's where the water was supposed to drain for the overfill. Well, the contractor failed to do the grading and the civil work, the civil engineering work, properly. And as a result, the houses in that cul-de-sac, specifically my clients, flooded in the basement. And the subdivision developer and the party who sold the house to my client knew that, and went in, and part of this was some fraud, repainted the basement, and never disclosed to my client that this house suffered flooding problems. My client moved in, got to the spring, the house flooded. And they flooded again and again, and they tried to figure it out. And the people that came in that tried to do work on it said the cost to rip out everything and the drainage tiles you needed to do around the house and seal the house was going to be like another $150,000, which my client did not have the money for. As we got a little bit more investigation, we determined that this contractor was aware. And so instead of suing, we could have sued him for fraud, but my client didn't want the house. Like, I don't want this house. It leaks. It floods. And I don't want to live here because it's not healthy for my kids. But I can't sell it because the law says if I know it floods, I have to disclose that. So I'm going to take a loss. So either I spend $150,000 more to fix it, who knows if that'll work, or the $500,000 house I bought, I have to sell for $400,000, I take a $100,000 loss there. Either way, I'm going to lose money. I could have sued, and at the end of the day, maybe I can't sell it, I don't know. So we could have sued for expectation damages. I expected a house that didn't leak. I'm going to have to spend another $150,000 to have a non-leaky house. That would be an expectation damage remedy. That would have been a monetary legal remedy. My client was like, I don't want to be here. They lied to me. I don't want to have anything to do with it. So we went into court, and we ask for rescission. We ask for an equitable remedy. And we use the facts of that the contractor developer knew. And we said, we want to rescind this contract like it never existed. We just want to pack up and move, and we want our $500,000 back because we had to be like it never existed. And so we got rescission. So the court said, and the court found in our favor, they rescinded the contract. They required them to return us the $500,000, and they said, because there was effectively no true meeting of the minds, the contract never existed. We rescinded it. And that's a rescission issue. So that had some construction issues, had some real estate issues, had some fraud issues, but at the end of the day, the remedy, my client's choice, was to rescind. Not to get money, but to get out. Equitable. It was the equity of it, not the monetary compensation. Does that make sense? Okay. Last one here, on this page, and there's two more that we talked about in the earlier slide, is what's called specific performance. Specific performance is kind of like an injunction, but it's requiring the performance of the actual contract. In the injunction, you're maybe enjoining somebody to do an action that there may not have been a contract. Like the government never entered into a contract with you that says, I'm going to put a road through you. They just declared eminent domain, they offered you a price, and then they moved for an injunction on that. Or you moved to preclude them on the injunction. So there never was necessarily a contract for the injunction that required the injunction. Sometimes there's some things. In specific performance, what the court's going to do there is they're going to say, you are required to perform exactly what's in the contract. Now, it has to, not has to, but most of the time specific performance is awarded when it's unique. And land is important in that sense. So they're not going to necessarily require you to perform services. They're not going to say, you must build the building this way. They're not going to require that. And there's some things about indentured servitude and some other public policies about that. But if there's and where specific performance comes in most of the time, is if there's a sale of land. I wanted to buy this property in this area, and you can't, and the contractor says, the developer says, well, I got another one a block away, or I got another one like four blocks away. It's the exact same size lot. We'll put the exact same house on there. And I'm like, no. I bought this lot because I wanted this area. I like the neighbors. I like the view, whatever it is. The uniqueness of the nature of what was supposed to be performed obligates the court to require specific performance. You must, if they pay you the value of the price you agreed upon, you must sell them that. So that's a specific performance requirement. Now, as I said, you can't have specific performances on services. If you hire me to cut the lawn and I don't cut your lawn, you can't go in and force me to cut your lawn. Because, again, that's forcing indentured servitude, slave labor. I don't want to do it. I shouldn't have to be forced to do something as far as services against my will. Monetary damages, you could say, well, if you were going to cut the lawn for $10 and I had to spend $20, well, you can get expectation damages. I had to spend $20 as opposed to $10, you owe me an additional $10. Same thing for you'll hear from time to time, somebody signs up to be in a movie. And then you see, oh, they pulled out. They're not going to be in the movie. They had to recast it. The court couldn't order the famous star to be in that movie, even though it was unique. Obviously, clearly, I'm going to hire George Clooney to be in this movie. That's the big selling point of getting this movie out, is I get this huge bank star. And obviously unique. The court cannot order specific performance that says, Mr. Clooney, you must act in the movie. Now, there could be an argument that some reliance damages could be recovered based on the contract that breached that Mr. Clooney failed, George Clooney failed to be in the movie, or even expectation damages. We expected that this movie would make X dollars because Clooney was going to bring in box office. We had to hire somebody else, Jake Gyllenhaal. It didn't bring in as big a box office, or whatever it might be. So the courts are going to say, for those types of things, There may be monetary damages, and you have to figure out how to prove those. But we will never require specific performance, no matter how unique that is. George Clooney is only George Clooney, no matter how unique it is, for performances of services. Okay? All right. Two other types of remedies. Now, these are going to be not necessarily equitable. These are actually going to be monetarily based. But there are other types of damages that you can recover. And these are definitely going to be, these two, and then two more that are, we just call them other types of damages. These two for sure are definitely relevant for construction. So the first are consequential damages. So what's a consequential damages? Well, as I said here, it's an indirect damage that's remotely caused by the breach. Now, it has to be foreseeable. The parties need to understand, oh, this could come up if you fail to perform. But as a consequence of you breaching, I incurred non-direct damages, damages that are not related to the work you're supposed to do. So, how does that work? Well, let's say that one of the examples I said was you're going to hire me to build you a candy factory. And we're going to agree that the candy factory has to be up and running by August 1st, because my biggest season is Halloween, and it rolls right into Christmas. And so I need to have the production lines up and running by August 1st so I can get the kinks worked out and start selling candy, rolling them off the line, packaging, shipping, and get them into the stores so they're there by September 1st, so when people start going and buying their Halloween candy, it's there. Well, the project gets late, and it's not delivered August 1st, it's delivered September 15th, maybe September 30th. Well, now I'm going to be late getting my lines up. There's no way I'm going to hit the candy season for Halloween, and who knows if I'm going to hit the Christmas season the way I wanted to. In that instance, I've lost money for the sale of candy. But the project was done on budget. It was late. I didn't have to pay you more. It was a $10 million factory. I paid you $10 million. So the contractor's going to say, well, wait a minute. I delivered it. I was late, but I delivered it. So why should you get damages from me? Well, it's a consequence of your failure to perform, because the contract said you're going to build it for $10 million and you're going to finish it by August 1st. And as a consequence of your breach to August 1st, it wasn't such a material breach that I would terminate you, but your breach of not hitting August 1st, the consequence of that means I lost business, I lost profits. And as a result of those lost profits, I lost money. And so I'm entitled to consequential damages. And in fact, consequential damages in some ways is a reliance damage. It wasn't the cost to finish the project. It was you promised me you would finish on time. And as reliance on that being finished on time, I ended up losing money because I couldn't sell my candy. So that's your consequential. It's a secondary damage that's a consequence of the breach for the primary work under the contract. And again, it must be reasonably foreseeable. I can't come and say, well, I'm going to lose money in for Easter sales. Well, that's not reasonably foreseeable. What does August have to do with Easter sales? But it was certainly reasonably foreseeable between the parties that if I couldn't sell, I couldn't get the lines up and running, that I was going to lose money at Halloween. So that's, yeah, the parties need to say, well, that makes sense. Or I couldn't come back to and say, as a consequential damage of you being late, it cost me more money for advertising. Well, what does advertising have to do with your advertising budget? Have to do with whether the project was done on time. So there's some things that they're so far remote, they wouldn't be a recoverable consequential damage. But some are. Now, the last bullet here on the consequential damages, it says it's often disclaimed in construction contracts. And the reason being is this very issue. Why should a contractor whose job is to build the building be able to be responsible for this loss of business, loss of profits, for something unrelated to what they're doing? I mean, you would argue, well, God, I'm going to lose this money, so you should have to pay for it. Why should you, contractor, get out of it? Why should I have to waive my consequential damages? And part of it is, and the reason why it's waived in construction contracts, is because there are so many unknowns of what could be consequential damages, or that the losses could be so exorbitant. Take, for example, one of my clients who was a casino operator. And we were building a casino for them down in outside of New Orleans. And so in that, they wanted to have consequential damages, my client. And we ultimately waived them and supplemented them with liquidated damage, which I'll explain in a second. And the reason why was that no contractor would bid on the project. Because if you can imagine, the amount of money that a casino makes on slot machines alone on a daily basis is in the millions. And so a contractor who's building this casino, it was about a $150 million project, the lost profits of the revenue, if they didn't open the doors on time for the company to start making money in gambling, would have been so astronomical that the contractor could never cover its risk of loss. It could never insure over it or anything else. So they said, there's no way I'm going to bid on this project if I don't have a waiver of consequential damages. The risk that you're putting on me as the contractor is so great, but it's not fair. So I'm not going to bid on it. So the unknowns are often too great, and that's why the parties do a mutual waiver of consequential damages. Both sides say, all we're going to do is sue each other for direct damages, and these extraneous outside consequential damages, we're going to waive. We can't bring a claim against each other. So that's why in construction, there's traditionally a waiver of consequential damages. In fact, I would go so far as to say, I don't think anybody in the construction industry should ever enter into a contract, whether you're an architect, an owner, or a contractor, without the mutual waiver of consequential damages. It's filled with too many risks, too many issues. So if you're ever out there and your company that you work for or you're working on your own and you're putting together a contract and you don't see anything about consequential damages in there, literally Google waiver of consequential damage, you'll find the language, stick it in, because that'll protect you, make it mutual, so both sides have to do it, but it'll protect everybody in this issue. Any questions on consequentials? So, as I said, the next thing you do, though, what happens to this casino or this candy company? Why should they, though, potentially not necessarily be penalized, but why should they then carry the loss? Look, I relied on you to get finished with my factory on August 1st, and you were late. Well, I'm going to lose millions, or maybe tens of thousands. Who knows? I'm going to lose lots of money because I'm not being able to ship my candy by Halloween, my big season. Why should you, as the contractor, be able to skate free? Why should I give you this waiver of consequential damage? Well, you shouldn't. So how do you cover for that? Well, you put in what's something called liquidated damages. Liquidated damages is at the beginning of the project. You say, let's calculate a figure, an actual per-day value that is hard to calculate later. Loss of profits, loss of business, those things that the consequentials that you waive are so smoky. You're not sure exactly what they are. You can't really get your arms around them. And it's hard to calculate even when they come up. You know, is it really lost profits? Would you really have sold that much candy? Did you have the distribution networks? Did you have the reputation in the industry? How do we calculate really lost profits? Well, you don't. With liquidated damages, in the very beginning, you say, let's figure out a per-day value. And for every day after August 1st that you don't deliver on time, you owe me that money, no questions asked. I don't have to prove that I actually lost that money. I don't have to prove a thing. We agree up front that it's X dollars a day, and for every day that you are late, you owe me those dollars. That's a liquidated damages. You liquidate it, you create a dollar figure in the beginning. Now, it can't be a penalty. It can't be so exorbitant, so outrageous, that it's only deemed to be a penalty. And you can't say, well, I was going to sell $1 million of candy per day. If there's no way, there's no basis, and so this reasonable relationship between it, there's no way I could prove that. Even if I was able to go through, there's no way. It can't be a penalty. You can't penalize someone. Because if you remember the very early slide, the purpose of remedies is not to penalize the breaching party, but it's to make whole the party who was injured. And so what you have is you have this calculation at the beginning, it's a per day number, and it's reasonably related. Now what's interesting here, I think I told you I represent utilities. So in the utility industry, one of the things that happens is you're out there and you're burning coal or whatever the facility is, and you make electricity every day. But the way certain states are, they regulate. And that every so many months, you have to shut down, because you really can't shut down while you're making electricity. You have to keep running, running, running. Everybody wants electricity every day. So you're not allowed to shut down and do repairs and everything else. So there's what's called an outage. And during that outage, you do construction work. And so what often happens is in this very short window, maybe 5 weeks, 10 weeks, they come in and they do work. And they'll do construction work on fixing things or correcting things. And if the construction is not finished when the outage is done, and you can't turn the switch back on and start making electricity, the electrical company gets fined and penalized by the government because everything's regulated as timing of when things are supposed to be operating. So to cover that, you put in liquidated damages. Because the government's going to fine me as the electrical company if you're late. So I shouldn't carry that risk, you should. Or let's say you're building a brand new candy factory. I may have, well, it may not be $1 million a day, I may be able to prove a large dollar figure of value of the cost to service the land, pay my rent, my utilities, and also what the loss of the candy sales are. So just as an example, on my utility companies, a common liquidated damages is somewhere between $200,000 and $400,000 a day. Or one of my clients that is a candy company, that liquidated damages was smaller because of the cost thing, but it was $50,000 a day. And so liquidated damages can be huge amounts. I've seen projects, the casino I worked on, that liquidated damage actually was $1 million a day because the casino was going to lose many more millions than $1 million a day. So they can be very, very large figures and not be deemed a penalty so long as it's reasonably related to the actual services or the issues around the potential actual loss of damages. So that's liquidated damages. You will see these often in construction. You won't see them necessarily on the architect side, but you will often see them in the construction side for the contractor. All right. Couple other kinds. Punitive damages. So this is, by its own nature, the penalty. And you almost never see punitive damages in a breach of contract. Where you're going to see it is if there was fraud. So you have a contract, but one side defrauded the other, and then there was a breach. So not only did the party fail to perform its promise, there's the breach, but in entering into the contract or in the process of performing, they committed fraud. And so the courts will come back, and they may enter a punitive awards, maybe based on statutory reasons or otherwise. The punitive damages do take a regular damage, and sometimes they can triple it. So you may see a treble damage. So there's sometimes a punitive award. As I said here, they're similar like a criminal fine, but instead of getting fined by the state or local government, the courts enforce this punitive award, and you have to pay the other side. So sometimes you may hear something like, you know, the conduct was so egregious, the court ended up ordering treble damages. You know, sometimes they get hit with that, and that's often going to be appealed, and sometimes the values are reduced. But it is in a very, very rare type of circumstances, you can have punitive damages, but I rarely see it in construction. I just wanted to highlight that it exists out there. And then the last thing is the type of recovery of damages under if there's a breach of contract is legal fees and costs. Unless it's written into the contract, you can't get it. So normally, if it's silent, if the contract doesn't say, if one party breaches, I'm entitled to my fees and costs incurred in enforcing the contract. If it's silent on that, the courts aren't going to award it. But if it does say that, that legal fees are recoverable, then the courts can't award. And the courts are given quite a bit of leeway on the value of what's reasonable and what's allowable. I had a case that went to trial a number of years ago. It was both sides were suing each other. So the one side was suing my client for $8 million, and that was expectation damages. And my client was suing the other side, counter-suing the other side for $2 million, and those were reliance damages. So both of them, both types of theories were in there. And so the delta between those two was $10 million. Now, the contract had a legal fee and cost provision. So we went to trial, and we won. So their $8 million case was tossed, and we won on our $2 million case. And so after we were awarded, the court came back and entered the award for our case. We then submitted a legal fee claim because we didn't know what our fees were until the trial was over. And our legal fees were in excess of $1 million. So the court came back, and I was literally sitting, myself and my partner at the time, we were in the conference room because he didn't have it in the chambers, and he looked at me and my partner, and he said, "Your contract says you're entitled to reasonable attorney fees. And I know you guys are really good lawyers, and I know you did a really good job out there, but I'm going to tell you what reasonable is. And it certainly isn't $1.3 million you're asking for, because I don't believe it's reasonable." And so he dramatically hacked our legal fee claim because they're entitled to do that. And the courts will do that because they don't want you to go to trial based on fees alone. In fact, the other side was so upset because they really thought they were going to get their fees, that we think they tried the case because of fees, because I thought their case was a lot weaker than ours, hence that's why they lost. But know that you can get legal fees and costs, it must be written in the contract, but the courts kind of get the last word on how much you really recover. Okay, so those are all the things, remedies and everything else, that the offending party must pay. Well, what does the innocent party have to do? I mean, do they just sit back? And the answer here is no. No matter what happens, no matter how things go, if there's a breach of contract, you, in certain instances, the party who has been offended, the party who has suffered the breach, suffered the loss, are required to try to mitigate your damages. So if you fail to mitigate, the court may come back and say, "You didn't do enough to minimize your claim, and so I, as the court, am going to go ahead and make an adjustment." In this instance, like an example would be in construction. Let's say that there was a breach of contract. I'm the owner, and the contractor fails to perform, and you have to terminate the contractor because of their breach. There's a whole bunch of steel sitting on the project site that hasn't been put into the facility. And during the lawsuit and during the hassle of getting rid of this contractor and being a new contractor, that steel sits on the project site, and you don't have the money because you're tied up in the court suit or whatever it might be, so the project's put on hold. You finally straighten things out at least enough for the project to continue. You go to hire a new contractor, and you're going to sue for that rest of that expectation damages, right? Because you have to pay the new contractor probably more money. And the new contractor comes to you and says, "We have to replace 3/4 of the steel because it's so rusted out. It's been sitting outside, not covered, not protected. So we have to spend all that money. We have to spend $1 million on new steel." And so you say, well, I should be entitled to that because the other side had breached, and we have to get new steel, and I expected not to have to pay for steel twice. So I get that additional $1 million, and so that's part of my claim for the expectation damages. Well, the court's going to come back and say, "Well, wait a minute. No. As soon as you terminated that contractor and that steel was sitting on your property, you needed to mitigate your losses. That means you needed to, at the very least, put that steel under cover. Do something so it would not rust, because it was in fine shape when the contractor was terminated. And had you not terminated them, had they performed the work properly, you wouldn't have had to have bought steel twice. And as a result, I am not going to award you that $1 million to buy the steel a second time because you failed to mitigate your damages. So, don't just sit on your, you know, sit back on whatever happened and say, I don't have to worry about it. You actually, as the innocent party, need to minimize your own costs that you're going to bring in a claim against the other. That's your mitigation of risk. Yeah. Yeah, so the question is mostly to the listeners here, but if you incur cost to mitigate your losses, can those mitigation costs be recoverable? And the answer is yes, because you are obligated to mitigate so your losses don't become greater. And since you're obligated, those losses would be expectation damages. They're directly resulting from the contractor's breach, and a direct result of that, a direct damage, is something you incurred. So you never expected to pay those additional costs for protection of the potentially rusted steel or what have you. And so your mitigation costs are recoverable as an expectation damage loss because you're doing what you're supposed to do. So that's a good question. Anything else on this? Okay, that is it for contracts. I will obviously talk about contracts during the rest of the semester, but I wanted to let you know that those are kind of the high-level stuff, and then next week we're going to talk about some torts and some other injuries, but this is your basis of contracts. All right, so now what we're going to do is we're going to run through insurance. Now, I spent a lot more time on contracts than I'm going to spend on insurance. And what I want you to understand about insurance, there's going to be a few things of insurance kind of in the quiz, the exam, but it's not going to be heavily rated insurance. So I'm going to talk about these. I'm going to kind of go through these a little bit faster. Insurance can get very dry. It can get very boring. And so what I want you to understand are just the basics. This is the types of insurance there are. This is what you need to protect yourself and the reasons why. And then we're not going to get into a lot of like how payouts are, how carriers look at it and everything else. So there will be a couple insurance questions, but it's not going to be super high level. All right. So let's talk about first the type of insurance, since you guys are architects, design professionals. We're going to talk about what's the type of insurance you're going to have for a design professional. Well, it's called professional liability insurance, sometimes errors or omissions, because you may commit an error or your drawings had AD missing something, so it's an error or omission. They are to cover negligent errors or omissions by the architect. Okay, so it's not to say, you know, if there's an intentional, there's a question of what that covers in, but the language in the policy normally says it's for your negligence. You just made a mistake because you're human. So, what are the key terms and concepts? And some of these are going to be in any type of insurance. These four things here, the limit, the deductible, retroactive date premium, those are all for all types of insurance, but let's just talk about them with respect to, hold on, did somebody leave? With respect to an error in submission policy or professional liability. Okay, first, there's the coverage limit. The coverage limit is the maximum amount that the policy will pay. Now, that doesn't mean that the architect will only be liable for that, depending on the language. So if you enter into a project with $1 million insurance policy, an E&O insurance policy, and there's a $2 million loss, well, the insurance company is only going to have to pay up to $1 million. That's just what the maximum policy limit is. So one of the things that you need to do when you're getting into a project is determine what's the value of the risks here and how much insurance should you carry. What's really going to potentially happen? And that's going to cause and drive the amount of limits. For that, you got to talk to a broker. They're going to look and analyze the project, some other stuff. So coverage limit is the maximum amount the policy is going to pay. Now, One unique thing about an E&O or a professional liability policy is the limit value covers two things. It covers the loss the other side potentially incurred, and it covers the attorney's fees that the architect who's been sued has to pay. So it covers both. The commercial general liability that a contractor carries does not include attorney's fees. So architects' policies, professional liability policies, are different in the sense that that million, and you want to think about this as if you're ever representing an owner and they on their side, like what I always tell an owner is, well, you have a $1 million policy, but if you sue that architect may spend $300,000 in litigation fees, and the most you're ever going to recover from that is $700,000, because there's the $1 million minus the $300,000, so all that's left for you is $700,000. So you want to figure that out is when you want to try to settle it otherwise. And that's where this concept here is where it says there's a decline balance. So every time the attorney submits its bill for the services they're performing, the $1 million is cut out of, and so that value declines. And so you want to look at the claim that's being made and how much money is being spent on litigation and how much is available if you want to settle. Maybe you want to settle earlier than later so you get, as the injured party, the biggest payout. Okay. Next thing, deductible. Well, deductible, some of you guys probably, or many of you guys probably from time to time had a car, like an auto insurance. And deductible is just as, if there's an injury or loss that the insurance company needs to step in, you, as the policy holder, must pay that deductible first. It's money coming out of your pocket. So every month you're going to be paying your insurance company, or every 6 months, whatever it is, your premium. But at the same time, once there's a claim, in order for the insurance company to pay out that $1 million, you may have to pay a $50,000 deductible. That's kind of their first cash. Dollar one comes out of you first. So that's your deductible. And deductibles are in all insurance policies. Next, retroactive date. Well, that's the earliest date of when the error or omission which the coverage will apply. Now, that's something that, like, policies are issued on a yearly basis. You know, it's not January 1, it just depends on when you first signed up. So, you know, it could go from March 1st to February 28th of the next year. And every year they do that. And so the retroactive date may be applicable to when the error or omission occurred or when the claim was made. You want to look to see which policy is applicable by its retroactive date. And then finally, the premium is it's what you pay. Whether it's annual, I have annual here, annual or semi-annual, just to have the insurance in place. And that's just like any other insurance. See, the insurance company charges you, like, for my auto insurance and my home insurance, every 6 months I write a check to State Farm. So those are all pretty common. And these will be applicable in all of insurance policies, other than, as I said, the unique part here is the policy for an E&O policy is both the loss and the attorney's fees. That's unique to an E&O policy. Any questions on that so far? Okay. Now, what else about an E&O policy? So this is another unique part of it. An E&O policy is what's called a claims-made policy. So remember I said that they occur you get a new policy every year. So claims-made policy means that the one that is applicable, the policy that you trigger, is for when the claim is made. What does that mean? Well, I design a cafeteria for your school, a new cafeteria for your school. And it turns out, obviously, I designed it for you in 2019. It gets built in 2020. People start going to school and using the cafeteria in 2021. So I performed the services in 2019. And it turns out in 2022, there's a problem with the HVAC system that I designed. The kitchen stays too hot. You can't get enough ventilation. There's problems with the food because of the ventilation issues. And so you, as the school district, make a claim against me for a design error in 2022. I designed it in 2019. I claimed in 2022, so that's 3 years, so that's within that 4-year statute of limitations, so the claim's still good. The policy that's triggered is the 2022 policy. Even though I designed it in 2019 and it was built in 2020, and they were using it in 2021, the claim was made in 2022. And so that's the insurance company will look at the policy in place in 2022. Okay? Claims made. And so as a result, if I'm designing and doing work for you in 2019, and I promise in my contract that I'm going to carry $1 million insurance, in 2022, or however long that statute of limitations of when I can get a claim against me, I should probably make sure I continue to carry that amount of insurance. Because if I fail, let's say I said I would be carrying a $1 million insurance policy for you based on this contract, and then in 2022 my business is down, I'm not working as much, I'm looking to retire, so I reduce my policy to $500,000. The claim comes in 2022, if I'm only carrying a $500,000 policy, I've committed breach because I promised $1 million. So there's all these problems with that. So you got to remember, as an architect and any contractor or whatever, because a claim's made, you have to carry that policy and continue, and that's what we call here is a tail. So you have to have this tail to make sure that you're covering all your obligations in your contracts. The tail has to extend out for a certain period of time to cover potential future claims because it's claims made policy. Does it make sense, this whole timing issue for claims made? Okay? All right. For architects, deductibles are pretty large. $50,000 if you're a small architect carrying $1 million policy. But if you're carrying a $3 million or $5 million policy, you may see at a bigger firm, which they'll probably carry something that big because they have lots of work going on, you may see a $250,000 deductible. Not uncommon to see $250,000. Some projects are even a $500,000 deductible. So that's dollars out of the architect's own cash pocket before the contractor or before the insurance company will kick in. And then what you want to look at also at this last part here, the premium is a function of your coverage limits, deductible, claims history. So there's a whole, how much you have to pay for your premium, what's your annual amount, is based on a lot of factors. Kind of like if you're driving a car. If you haven't been in an accident for 5-10 years and you only drive your car a little bit and some other stuff, your deductible or your premium that you pay to Allstate or State Farm is going to be pretty small. But if you're somebody that's been in a number of accidents, the premiums will go up. That's the same thing. In construction, though, you look at a 5-year claims loss history when they calculate how much your insurance is going to cost. One last slide in professional liability. If there is a claim to be made, and again, this is important in all insurance, it should be reported promptly. So if you're an injured party and you want to have a claim made, you should have reported, or a claim is made. So if you're the architect and the claim is made against you for a design defect, you want to promptly report that to your carrier. You want to, even if they haven't filed a lawsuit, they called me up and said, there's HVAC problems with my kitchen area, and I'm investigating it. That may be enough that you should call up your broker or your carrier to say, they're looking to make a claim against me. And the reason why is insurance companies will say if you delay in notifying them, they can actually get out of providing insurance. So always, if there's claims made against you, make sure you get that to your insurance company as quickly as possible. And then the last thing here, and again, this definitely will not be in the test, but I want you to understand it in case you get into an action, is there's this weird tripartite relationship in insurance with architects, well, in all insurance issues. So because, well, I'm sorry, no, it's just on the architects, not on the contractor side. Because money's coming from your $1 million policy to pay both the loss and the architect, and you're not paying the architect, the insurance company's paying the architect, there's a question as to whom is the architect loyal? I'm defending the attorney. Who is the attorney loyal? I'm defending the architect, but I'm being paid by the insurance company. Well, the law says they need to be loyal to you. Even though the check is coming from somebody else, they need to be loyal to you. And so there's specific duties of that. Often you're going to have an attorney that does this insurance defense work that always is getting business from insurance companies, but they still have their duty of loyalty to the architect. And if there's some conflict of interest, sometimes what you may have is a situation where, and I had a case like this, this is a very specific case, where the owner, or the architect was being sued by an owner, and they wanted to settle. They wanted to get out of the lawsuit. They didn't like how it was affecting their reputation. They thought there was a chance that their million-dollar policy wasn't going to be enough and they would have to be paying money out of pocket. So they instructed their attorney, settle this case as quickly as you can. I don't care what it is, but see if you can get it in for under $1 million. The attorney went back to the insurance company and said, okay, they want to settle. The insurance company's like, no, we don't like writing checks. Don't settle. And the attorney says, well, but my loyalty is to the architect. He says I got to try to settle as quickly as possible. And the insurance company says, nope, don't settle. We don't want to spend the check. I don't care what your architect says. In that instance, there's a conflict between the two parties that are related. And so for there, the first attorney in tells the insurance company, you need to hire a second attorney to represent you. And we'll figure out this second part because you don't want to write the check. I still owe my duty of loyalty to the architect. So, for just purposes of this concept here, and again, it won't be an exam, but when you get, if you get, not when, but if you ever into a claim, the attorney that's representing you, they're on your side. And if they ever come back to you and say, the insurance company says no, you got to tell them and remind them, there, you're on my side. If the insurance company is being squirrely, tell them to get their own attorney. You're my attorney, not the insurance company's attorney. So that's just kind of in this whole kind of tripartite relationship. Next. Practice versus project policies. So what's that? And again, this one will not be in the exam, the difference between these two, but I want you to understand them because it comes up in almost every project, or not every project, but many projects, especially those of size. So as an architectural firm, or a junior contractor, you're going to carry a practice policy, meaning for during your practice. Every year, I'm always going to have this million-dollar policy in place for all my projects. That's what I do as a practice of it, and I carry it. But now you get hired for this $70 million project, and it's got some high-tech design work and everything else, and the owner comes to you and says, I need you to carry $3 million worth of insurance. For that instance, you go back to your insurance broker and you say, for this one project, I need $3 million. I'm not going to up it because I'm normally just a home designer. I'm not going to be carrying $3 million for every one of my homes because that's more expensive. I pay premiums for the whole year and blah, blah, blah. But for this one project, I'm going to do a project policy. And for that, you're going to have the increased $3 million. So there's a difference between the two. And it's popular because then the exact cost you incur for that project policy, you pass it directly to the owner. If there's a lawsuit, you only have to deal with this project policy. You don't have to be competing interests with other claims on the practice policy. It just kind of sits out there on its side. So there's some value to it, and it'll come up from time to time, depending on the work that you do. So it also is something that will operate outside of your budget. When you do a practice policy, you say, well, this is my annual costs. When you do a project policy, it's just a one-off. So those are some things about policy, practice policy versus project policies. And they do practice versus project policies on the contractor side too. And those, it's called a CSIP, a contractor-controlled insurance program, or an OSIP, an owner-controlled insurance program. So, that's your professional liability. If you commit an error or omission in your design services, professional liability has to do with the services you perform. A different type of insurance is called commercial general liability insurance. So commercial general liability insurance can be issued again to the architect, and the next slide will be the contractor. It has nothing to do with your designs. It has to do with, say, slip and falls, or some other type of accident that may occur that's unrelated to your design services. Now, you want to carry it because somebody could be coming to your office and slip and fall, or you could be on the project site and something happens and they're injured for whatever reason because of you. So if it's not design related, you have to have some insurance. So you want to carry commercial general liability insurance. What's nice about that, and that's just kind of like, not necessarily a homeowner's policy, but it's just kind of this basic $1 million policy you have. Because it's not related to your practice of architecture, it's very inexpensive. Your premiums are really low. Your deductible may be $5,000 or $10,000. It's no $50 or $20 or $100 or $250. It's just a very small deductible. Because rarely do you have claims that somebody tripped in your office. The claims that are going to come against you are based on professional liability or errors or omissions claims. Here's the other difference between a professional liability policy and a commercial general liability policy is what's called an occurrence basis, not a claims made. So if someone slips and falls on the way into your office and breaks their arm in 2020, and they sue you in 2022 within the statute of limitations period, the policy that's triggered is the 2020 policy because the occurrence occurred in 2020. It's not when the claim is made, it's when the occurrence took place. Commercial general liability policies also do not pay attorney's fees. So those are your differences. Claims made is exactly what it is, when it's claim made. Occurrence is when the occurrence happened. Professional liability includes attorney's fees and the value of the limits. Commercial general liability, no fees. So those are your big differences between the two. Any question on that? So there's commercial. Now the next area of commercial general liability and national insurance is commercial general liability insurance for the contractor. This is the type of policy that covers the work that the contractor is performing, or more specifically, the work that the subcontractors are doing. There's all these issues about not your work and all these exclusions. We're not going to get into the specifics of that because it's a little bit too confusing. But what you want to think about for this slide and for this concept is if there is a loss or damage to the work, there's a bodily injury, there's performance things that are not done properly, this is when the contractor's commercial general liability policy will kick in. The owner and the architect are named as additional insurers, meaning they get the full benefit of the contract. Even the contractor is carrying the policy, the owner and the architect will be named, and they should be named, and they get the full benefit of that policy. So this is where, if there's a catastrophe, catastrophic damage or claims on a construction project, and the contractors get sued, the contractor will look to its commercial general liability policy or an excess or umbrella, like the kind of a larger chunk of it, to cover those losses. So, on a very high level, design defect, professional liability insurance, construction defect, commercial general liability insurance. Those are the two areas of coverage. All right? What other type of insurance do you want to have on a construction project? Well, you want to have auto insurance because you're driving to the project. You have to get there, and in the course of your duty, in the course of your work, if you get into an auto accident, you want to have that covered. So, and even if what will happen is even if it's your own car and you carry your own State Farm personal driver's insurance, if in the course of performing your duties, you're driving there, then you make sure that the company that you're working for, their policy would kick in. So that's what that. And it's contractors have it, owners have it, architects have it. Every construction contract I ever call or ever write, whether it's an owner-designer contract or an owner-contractor agreement or owner's rep or whatever it is, will have a separate insurance section, and it'll include a requirement for commercial general liability, it'll include a requirement for auto. And they're just basically just like the auto insurance that you're carrying right now. The limits are going to be higher. Most like you're probably, if you have a car, I carry a $300,000 limit. But on construction, it's normally a million. But other than that, it's pretty much the same as your own regular auto insurance you're carrying now. But you should have it on every project. And then, I guess the reason why, and I probably should have said this at the very beginning of the insurance discussion, the whole purpose of all of these policies that you want to have on every project is if something happens, some catastrophic issue occurs, most companies, especially small and mid-sized companies, can't afford on their own to pay those losses out of their pocket. And as a result, it could put them out of business. So it's just a risk, a risk sharing or risk factor that you are looking in on the operations of business. You know, how do you make sure your business stays alive and well and floating? You buy insurance. And so these are the types that you want to carry. And that I have I had one client. This is years and years ago. Small little architect outside of downstate Illinois. Worked on putting up barns and grain silos, and it was fairly cut and dry work. Pretty basic, pretty simple. Occasionally do somebody's, you know, like addition to their house. And it was just him. Just his own shop. He worked on, he didn't even have a computer. He did everything by hand. This is many, many years ago. He never carried insurance. Didn't carry auto. Didn't carry professional liability. And he got sued a couple times. That's why he was my client. And in both instances, luckily, the defect, both his design defect and the damage to the owner, was of such a nominal value, and the owner was suing the contractor because the contractor screwed up in the two cases that I represented him. I was able to negotiate, and I said to the owner's attorney in both instances, I said, my client has no insurance. He's the only guy that works for his company. He's unmarried. It's just himself. He owns a couple of desks. He owns an old computer to do his bills on. That's all he has. So even if you were able to recover a $50,000 recovery for it from him, there's no money. Because he doesn't have anything. He's got a beat-up old car. You can't make him sell his house. So here's $5,000. He's either going to pay it to you or pay it to me to defend him. You can take that and take that $5,000 and get out of the case. And I was luckily twice lucky to be able to do that for him. But it's because his risk profile was so small that he felt he didn't have to worry about it. I eventually talked him into getting insurance. He got sued. It was a major case. Thank God I did. So that was the third time, the last time I represented him. But he always thought, well, if I don't have insurance, I can always get out because you just tell him I have no money. But I told him that the risks were too great. So it happens, but rarely. And so in your instance, anytime you guys are out there, make sure you're carrying insurance. There's another type of insurance that comes on project. This is called builder's risk. Now, the builder's risk is going to be either carried by the owner or the contractor. And what's interesting about builder's risk is it covers or takes place for things that are not related to the work being performed by the contractor. It relates to the work that's already been done or materials stored on the site. And the loss is not caused by a construction defect or design defect. So think about this way. I'm building the factory for you. I've got two-thirds of the factory done, and I've done everything right as a contractor. And a fire starts, and the thing burns to the ground. You're the owner of the factory, and you sue me because you believe that the fire was caused by my negligent services, my negligent work. If it turns out that I had no negligence, if I didn't cause any issues to cause the fire, you recover zero from me. So then you try the architect. Well, the fire occurred because your design system overamped the electrical system and that's what caused the fire. And the architect says, well, but the electrical system and design was fine, plus it wasn't fired up, it wasn't in service because the building was only two-thirds built, so you can't recover from me. So I go, well, there's a loss there. So I don't get the money from the architect as the owner. I don't get money from the contractor as the owner because they both did their job. So now I go to my property insurance because the house, the factory is being built on property I own. The property insurance company comes back and says to me, no, no, no. it was a building under construction. We can't insure anything that's partially built. That's what your policy says. That's pretty typical. The value of the land will cover, but the land is worthless because there's nothing built on it. It's not finished. So we don't cover it there. So now you as the owner are stuck. You've lost in this $10 million factory that's two-thirds finished. You've lost $600 million, plus you got to clear it, plus you got to rebuild it. How do you recover that money? Builder's risk insurance. Builder's risk insurance has this finite line period of time. It's going to be in place during the course of construction. It's not commercial general liability, so it doesn't pick up stuff when the contractor screws up. Doesn't pick up stuff when the architect screws up. It picks up when something goes wrong. Fire, vandalism, tornado, whatever it might be. And then it insures for the work performed to date, the work in place, and the materials stored on site. So in that instance, when I go to the knock on the architect's door and the contractor's door and my property insurance carrier's door, and they all tell me no, I go to my builder's risk insurance company and I say, it burned down because it got struck by lightning or because there was vandals or what have you. And the builder's risk insurance company will write me a check for the $7 million. Doesn't matter who caused it as long as it's not related to the work being performed. Unless you went in and did it as the owner and you were trying to get, you know, insurance fraud. But that's what's important about it is that it fills this gap that exists while the project is being built. Now, once the project's over, the owner's property insurance kicks in. Now the building's worth $10 million and the owner's property insurance company says, okay, now we're insuring that whole building for $10 million. And when lightning strikes the next day after the project is finished and it burns to the ground, the property insurance writes a $10 million check because they don't have that gap anymore. But while it's under construction, while it's being built, you need the builder's risk to fill that gap. Okay? Any questions on that? One of the things that we talk about in builder's risk, so for an architect, is that there could be an issue where the architect, where the builder's risk company comes in and pays off that $7 million, but then turns around and sues the architect for negligence. They may try to make the claim that the architect did something wrong. That there was a defect in the design, that the electrical system was improperly designed. And so, in that instance, and this is what you want to try to avoid, the builder's risk insurance company, if you can imagine, being State Farm or Hartford or Aetna, one of these huge companies, have unlimited resources and dollars. And so, they will be able to, even if you, as the architect, have a pretty good defense that your designs were good, they may still come after you on what's called a subrogation claim, meaning I paid to you, owner, for your claim. You are now subrogating or giving my claim, giving me your claim. I'm taking your claim that I just paid out on, and they're going to use that to sue the architect. They may try to just strong-arm the architect because the architect screwed up, or maybe didn't screw up, and use their leverage as with lawsuits and forcing, that you may end up as the architect trying to have to settle because you just don't want to be in this lawsuit. So how do you recover against that? How do you make sure that that you as the architect aren't going against the giant insurance company, the David and Goliath? So this last paragraph here talks about a waiver of subrogation. And in that instance, what that means is you, when you enter into a contract with the owner, so this is a remember when I said every contract you enter into should have a waiver of consequential damages? Every contract you enter into with an owner should also have a waiver of subrogation. And what that says, and it should be mutual as well, what that says is, Mr. Owner or Mrs. Owner, if you get a claim against you, or if you have if an insurance company comes in and pays out on some claim and you recover your losses, owner, you are not allowed to subrogate or hand that claim over to the insurance company. If I'm going to battle against somebody in court for my potential negligence, it's going to be against the party I entered into a contract with, not this giant insurance company. So for today's lessons, two things on damages side. Make sure all your contracts have a waiver of consequential damages. And on the insurance side, make sure all your insurance riders include a mutual waiver of subrogation. So the owner can't hand over their claim to the insurance company after the insurance company's paid out, such that the insurance company can be coming after you. Doesn't mean that the owner won't come after you. Doesn't mean that you will get out of it. But what it does is it keeps the playing field more fair. You entered into an agreement with an owner. You know who they are. You know the risk involved. You know the parties. And you know what the work was being performed. If you have to battle against the insurance company, who knows what's going to be coming down the pike with them and their unlimited resources. Okay? One last type of insurance you're going to see on the project, that's called workers' compensation. Now, you're probably going to have some workers' comp for on the design professional side. But most of the time where this applies on a construction project is on the contractor side. Workers' comp is required in all states. It's a statutory requirement. And the way the statutes are written, not all of them in the states, it's all required statutorily, but the way the statutes are written is the value of the loss is already predetermined. So if some contractor is working and breaks a leg, you go to a chart and a broken leg has a value, and the workers' compensation insurance company pays that value. Or at another project, someone gets in an accident and their hand gets crushed and they have to have their hand amputated or a finger. Each extremity, each part of your body in certain states for workers' comp has a predetermined dollar value. And if there's that injury or loss to the worker, the workers' compensation insurance pays that value. So that's how it's structured. It's normally... the process of the payment of the insurance goes directly from the carrier to the worker who's injured. In most instances, the value of the payment is probably not going to be sufficient to cover the loss. So a figure may be worth $10,000, but the loss of a figure may be worth a lot more to you depending on what your work is. And so that worker is probably still going to bring a lawsuit. And then there's some issues about who has to pay. Let's say the verdict for that lost finger comes back at $50,000. The injured party's already been paid $10,000. Who pays the other $40,000? Is it his employer? Is it the other people in the field? Is it the owners? There's all these issues with that. But just understand for purposes of today's lecture and for understanding slides, is that it's a protection that's required under law that will pay out a certain value for an injury, normally done by the contractor, and it covers everybody that's working for you as a company. So it doesn't cover somebody else's work. So like if I work for the plumber on the project, and as a part of my work, the electrician who's working right next to me gets injured, the electrician can't bring a comp claim against my plumbing company. The electrician has a comp claim through his work, because it's all with who you work for, but the electricians can still sue the plumbing company if the work was done on a separate claim for their damages because the comp payment wasn't enough. Yeah. Exactly. Because your employer is carrying the insurance for you, and that was the way it's structured, if you get injured, when that insurance pays out, technically it's deemed that the employer has satisfied their obligations, and that's why the employee can't sue the employer. But because often the payout from the insurance is not sufficient for the value of the loss, that injured party will sue the other third parties. And that could be the owner, the contract, the main prime contractor, the plumber, if it was the electrician, the architect, because we're in America, you sue everybody. So yes, that's exactly right. That's a good understanding there. So, okay. One last slide on insurance and then we're done for today. When you enter into a contract, there's going to be, whether it's an exhibit or it's going to be a section in the contract, it should determine, or it should delineate the type of insurance you want for the project. You know, it's going to say, contractor should carry commercial general liability in the amount of $1 million plus an umbrella for $5 million. Carry auto for $1 million. Employer's liability and workers' comp statutorily required. And there may be other stuff. There may be, like nowadays, actually what I see almost in a lot of contracts, I didn't put it in the slide here, but a lot of projects I see nowadays is small craft or autonomic vehicles, because contractors use drones all the time to take pictures of the site and the progress of the project. Well, what happens if that drone crashes and hits somebody, or as it's taking off, the propellers, you know, goes crooked and takes somebody's eye out? Well, that's not going to be covered by your commercial general liability or your auto. So now I'm seeing that, and like lots of projects, is when they're bringing in these autonomic vehicles or the drones or whatever. So that's a type of coverage, other types of things. But you're going to have this exhibit, or you're going to have a section in your contract that's going to say this is the type of insurance you're carrying. And one of those provisions is going to say you need what's called a certificate of insurance. And that's literally a piece of paper, one or two pages. And it's called, at the top, it literally says certificate of insurance. COI is what I often refer to it. And that's something that's issued by an insurance broker. And it states, commercial general liability, $1 million. Umbrella, $5 million. Auto, $1 million. Workers' comp, statutory. It literally lists the type of insurance that the broker has procured for you, the date that it's become active, so you have this retroactive date, and the date that it will be expired, and then it will identify who's the party that's insured, who the additional insureds are, and if there's any exclusions or what have you. So you need to make sure that if you are requiring insurance from the other side, you get the certificate of insurance. It's a piece of paper that states that this insurance has been procured. It's in place. Now, the third bullet here says it's often the architect's responsibility to collect and examine. So what happens on a project is you enter this agreement with the owner, and you're going to do your design work, schematic, design development, construction documents. And then you're going to do one of the phases you may work with is bidding and negotiation, and then construction administration. So this is the part after the drawings are finished, completing the project. But during that bidding and negotiation phase, when the owner then goes out for an RFP and selects a contractor, one of your jobs as the architect and in your contract is to gather all the documents. You know, I need to see the permits, I need to see the surveys, I need to see, and in this instance, certificate of insurance. So often your job as the architect, that's why I want you to understand what these are, is the owner's not going to look at them potentially, you are. You're going to get them all in, you're going to look at them, you're going to say, oh yeah, I see the construction contract requires insurance A, B, and C. I look at the certificate of insurance, it says A, B, and C. Okay, check the box, let the owner know you're okay. So that's what's required to put in there, is you need to collect and examine and forward those certificates to the team. And it looks like I have that there twice, so probably I have it there twice because I want you to know it's twice as important. But it is something you're going to have to do for as one of your obligations. And then the last bullet here, so the certificate, as I said, it's a one or two pager that just describes the types of insurance, the value, and the time limits, the time frames or periods of when they're viable. If, however, you get into a situation where there's going to be a claim that's made or an occurrence policy triggered, in that instance, you may be called upon to actually look at the full insurance policy, because the certificate's just a summary, and the policy has all of the ins and outs of what coverage is and what the words mean, and that's the contract, interestingly enough. And you guys probably didn't even know this. When you get, when you buy insurance with from State Farm or Allstate or whatever, and they send you your policy, all that is a contract between you and the insurance company. And if you read that policy, what it's going to say is, it's going to say, if you pay premiums, I will do the following. So those are your promises. And it's going to say, if this happens in an accident, I will cover this. But if another thing happens in the accident, I won't cover this. So there's going to be terms and conditions of expectations, reliances, and all those things. So that is what this last bullet is to cover, is to say the certificate of insurance, that one pager, doesn't have the rules to monopoly. The insurance policy is a contract with the rules to monopoly, and you may need to kind of open up that rule book during the course of a construction claim, a defect, design or otherwise, in a project, to see what was really covered or not. Any questions on today? Okay. So right now, I've heard from most of you, not all of you. We still have a go back to order for school anyway, so it's not, it doesn't really matter at this point. So I'd only sent out the links through today for the Zoom. I will send one out definitely next week. I think what we may end up doing, we may stay because I'm seeing a little bit more of people that would have stay remote, but I haven't. I want to hear back from everybody, and then we'll chat about it. But next week I'll send out a number series of Zooms, so we'll be here regular time for that. All right. Thanks, guys. Yeah. You guys have a nice weekend. All right. Bye.